Welcome back. Thanks for downloading another episode of BingeCast. I'm Lori Butler.
And I'm Jeff Argin, and this is the podcast where we go out and we mine the landscape of podcasts and some streaming stuff, and we bring you our picks. And sometimes our picks are not what each other would pick, but that's kind of the fun of this whole thing. So what do we got going today, Lori?
Well, today we're going to be discussing last week's challenge. Each of us picked a piece of media that we thought the other person needed to see or hear. And we're also going to be discussing religion today, our favorite religious podcast.
Our favorite religious podcast. And don't run away when we just said religion, because religion is such a very, very broad topic. And we've got some very different types of podcasts that we've listened to and recommend, and interesting. It's not about religion. It's about that as a topic. But what I'm really curious about is our two challenges for each other.
Yeah. So let's start with that stuff
so
first.
So you challenged me to watch Umbrella Academy on Netflix, and I challenged you to watch the Seth MacFarlane. I almost said Seth Rogen. I want to say Seth Rogen all the time, but it's Seth MacFarlane, Million Ways to Die in the West. So we're going to get to those when we start talking about our recommendations and our wild cards for the week. So stay tuned for my thoughts on Umbrella Academy, of which I have a few.
Oh, good. You know, it's sort of like superhero movie light. So, you know, one of these days I will challenge you to watch some more Marvel. It's like a starter gateway drug.
Oh, this genre. This was not a gateway drug. This was like say no to drugs for me. Nancy Reagan could have produced the Umbrella Academy to keep me away from watching more Marvel movies. But we'll get to that, because it's not all negative. Mostly positive. But, and I'll leave it at that.
Okay.
So what do you have for your so-called religious podcast?
You know, I think the word religious is a misnomer
for this, actually.
Yeah, it is a tough word. It's kind of a, like I mentioned earlier, sort of a third rail topic. But I decided this week to check out a story podcast called The Rise and Fall of Mars Hill. And I found this so fascinating. But I got to tell you, the only thing that I could really critique on it right now is the fact that there's only two shows so far. Brand new.
Oh, so it keeps you waiting. Are you hooked?
I'm very hooked. Okay. I found it very engaging. The first two episodes, I believe, were about an hour, maybe an hour and a half each.
Okay, so substantial. Mm-hmm. They're telling some stories here.
Yeah, let me read for you the episode description. Founded in 1996, Seattle's Mars Hill Church was poised to be an influential, undeniable force in evangelicism. That is, until its spiraling collapse in 2014. The church and its charismatic founder, Mark Driscoll, had a promising start, but the perils of power, conflict, and a Christian celebrity eroded and eventually shipwrecked both the preacher and his multi-million-dollar platform. I read the description first before I listened to the first episode, and this was after previewing a bunch of other podcasts with religion as their topic. You know, this is not necessarily a podcast that you would listen to learn more about your faith or about the Lord. This is a podcast that you would listen to as a cautionary tale if you're a pastor, but also one that I could engage with personally, because the historic context of this story tracks with the last several decades that I've been a Christian. And I found that really fascinating, because it kind of hit on things I remember from the 70s and 80s related to evangelicism and television pastors and the like. So the show itself is hosted by a man named Mike Cosper, who I believe is a pastor, was working and was related in the staff for Mars Hill. So it was kind of coming from a very personal place.
So he's integral to this story.
Yeah, he was inside the story, really. And the podcast takes you inside the story, which was a church in Seattle. He follows it from its founding, and it becomes one of the largest mega churches in American history. So he takes you back in time to how mega churches became an institution in the United States, what kinds of people attend mega churches, you know, what that means and so forth. And in his interviews, he tells the history of people who experienced the triumphs and the losses of Marcel. This is more description I got from their website, so pardon me if it sounds like I'm just reading here, but it says, knowing it as both an amazing life-transforming work of God and as a dangerous, abusive environment. The issues that plagued Mars Hills and its founder, Mark Driscoll, dangers like money, celebrity, youth scandal, and power, aren't unique, and only by looking closely at what happened in Seattle will be able to see ourselves. Anyway, I thought it was challenging, and it was interesting, and it was relatable, and I would highly recommend it.
Was there one takeaway, positive takeaway that you had from that?
You know, in some of the interviews with the people who were at Mars Hill Church, listening to how they dealt with the inevitable end of their church, it broke my heart, you know, and the story's not over. I haven't been able to hear how it all came to be. There's only two episodes out right now. They come out once a week. So it's July at this point. So I'm expecting to see another couple of episodes in the next couple of weeks. I'm hoping they're planning, I think, 7 in the series. I'm still at the beginning of the narrative. You know, it's sad to see a church come to a close. I've experienced that in my own life. And it's heartbreaking, and it's a loss because it's a community that you belong to. Also reading about and hearing about this extremely charismatic speaker and then listening to some of his sermons, at the same time that I'm approaching it from this critical space, because that's what the story is, I'm also hearing things in his sermons that I can relate to. You know, I can understand why people would follow him. Like I was hearing his, like they would show snippets, play snippets of his sermons, and I go, oh man, this guy's good.
So this is if this was a active going church in this community, you might even become a member of that church.
I don't know if I would have become a member. He was a little out there, but when you hear the sound clips of Mark Driscoll's sermons, you can understand why people would follow him, because he was very no-nonsense, you know, very straight-talking. But at the same time, he said some very dangerous things. I think he got himself in trouble for real reasons.
Okay, I'm going to challenge you a little bit here. You said he was way out there. That's a bold statement when you're talking about religion, because religion, regardless of who you believe and what you believe, every one of them has statements of that's way out there.
I can't speak too much to everything that he taught because I never listened to a full sermon of his. And so I'm not, you know, an authority by any stretch. But just in the first two episodes of this short series, The Rise and Fall of Mars Hill, I can tell you that this very charismatic speaker was saying some very challenging things to the young men in his church, challenging them to be men. I guess you can say was sort of pushing these guys to kind of man up in a way that isn't all that politically correct, but sometimes does need to be said out loud. This guy was, I guess, ballsy enough to just come right out and say it. You got to respect people that tell their truths that way with such strength. But when you're coming at it from the position of a leader in a faith-based organization, some of the stuff he was saying was just a little too aggressive.
Give me an example. Because sometimes I think, it doesn't have to be a pastor. People want to tell somebody how to be when they don't really even know them. We can't all be what somebody tells us to be. We can only be what we can be, and we're influenced. But I always bristle when somebody, of course, that's my anti-authoritarian stance on the world and why I've had endless numbers of issues with bosses and teachers and you name it, because I'm not a big authority person. So the minute somebody tells me to do something, I'm going to question it.
Yeah, I'm not prepared to make a quote directly from the podcast because I didn't note it. But listening to his tone, you know, like calling the generation like snowflake generation, you know, of sensitive men, that kind of preaching.
He's grabbing political buzzwords and putting them into his sermons.
A little bit, yeah.
Yeah, that's tough.
But that's not all that he got him in trouble. And that's what I'm waiting to hear in these next couple of episodes. Because right now in these first two, they're sort of setting up a historic context. So they're going back to Jerry Falwell and Jim Baker and the 70s Jesus movement and then the rise of the suburban megachurch. And they're basically laying down this historic foundation to get to the story where we really get to hear what it was that Mark Driscoll said that really got him in hot water. You can hear in the podcast too how he has relationships with other mega church pastors who at one point aligned with him and have since broken off.
So he's carving his own way and unapologetic about it.
I think he is apologetic.
Oh, and now he is? Now he is.
You would kind of have to.
Did it all kind of start to fall apart?
But we'll see. We'll see. I still have a couple more episodes to go. So the only thing I guess I could say right now that I would criticize is the website. I had a tough time navigating the website. I wanted to try to find other episodes, and of course they're not there, but that wasn't it. I was sitting at my computer with my headphones on, you click a link and it was broken and you couldn't capture the audio off of the website itself. Seems like it needed a little bit of TLC.
Is this an independent podcast or is
it's actually produced by, well, it is an independent podcast, but it's produced by the big organization Christianity Today.
Okay.
Which is a magazine.
So they're distributing it, but it's an independent production.
Yeah. So if you start off by going to Christianity Today, they actually have other podcasts. There's, I think, 6 or 7 on their website. But again, another site where you couldn't click the audio. For some reason, it wasn't working on my computer to be able to open it up and listen to it that way. But I accessed it on Apple Podcasts, and I'm assuming it's going to show up on other platforms as well.
Yeah, most likely. If it's on a big network like that, it's probably available everywhere.
Mm-hmm.
So, all right. And the title of that one again?
The Rise and Fall of Mars Hill.
Rise and Fall of Mars Hill. Is Mars Hill the name of the church or the name of the guy?
It is. It's the name of the church. The pastor's name was Mark Driscoll, and the host for the show is Mike Cosper.
What's Mike's connection into the podcast?
He was a staff member.
Okay, so it's an insider story.
Mm-hmm. The episodes have news footage and archival interviews and other sounds that are linked in, so it's a beautifully produced show.
Since this guy was an insider, is he giving you insider point of view, or is he trying to kind of whitewash the story to manipulate the message?
He's actually being very objective, because very little of the voice of the podcast is coming straight from Mike. It's a lot of it is compiled interviews. It felt very much like something that you'd hear on Serial or one of the large NPR productions, you know. It had that kind of slick quality that you look for in a really good podcast, where you have lots of sound and audio and music and mixing, and, you know, the editing is fantastic. So very professionally done. Mike Cosper, his voice pops in occasionally, but it's not like he's telling the whole story. He's bringing you all the parts and pieces to put it together.
So he's kind of a host facilitator of the material.
Yeah.
Yeah. All right. Good. All right. I look forward to that. That's sort of right in my wheelhouse. I love those things. So I have a religion, I don't know if it is or not, podcast to recommend. I just stumbled upon this one as I was looking for skepticism. I'm looking for religion. My religious affiliation is none, but I am fascinated by religions. I spent a good deal of my time in my life reading about religion and different religions and studying them. And I always felt that if I was going to have an intelligent conversation about religion, I better have some knowledge. As you wander through life, you meet a lot of people from a lot of different religions, and I felt like I should know a little bit about what their religion is. I did quite a bit of research. I read a lot of books. I watched a lot of documentaries of all different kinds. And what I often found is the average person that I would run into from a certain religion, I knew more about the history of their religion than they did, because I was interested in the history and how they got to be where they were. Sometimes in religions, we don't like to look too far back in our own history of our religion, because it can be a little bit bleak, just like it is in our country and just like it is in our lives. But we move forward and we evolve, and I don't judge a religion necessarily on what they've done in the past. It's what are they doing right now. So sometimes folks don't always have their information right. Off on a little tangent. So my podcast this week is The Turning. And this was interesting to me because this is about Mother Teresa's sect of nuns that followed her teachings, followed her beliefs, and were involved in her ministry. Certainly they're Catholic, but it kind of goes beyond that. And I would say it doesn't border on, it actually is cult-like. It's very cult-like, and it's very, very bizarre in what they were doing and the demonstrations you'd have to do to demonstrate your faith and your belief. So this is done by a woman named Kelly Dunham. Kelly was raised in evangelical, but went to Catholic school because that was near her home. And she had a fascination with nuns. And what do these nuns do in the nunnery when you're leaving school and you walk by this big building? It's a mystery what goes on in there. And Kelly ultimately decided she wanted to become a nun and did for a brief time. So this is coming from somebody much like your podcast. They kind of know what they're talking about. They're insiders here. But she was not part of Mother Teresa's sect. So I'm going to read you their description is. Thousands of women gave up everything to follow Mother Teresa, joining her storied Catholic order, the Missionaries of Charity. But some found that life inside the fiercely private religious order was not what they'd imagined. Former sisters who worked closely with Mother Teresa describe her bold vision and devotion to charity and prayer, but they also share stories of suffering and forbidden love, abuse and betrayal. If you make a lifelong vow, what does it mean to break it? What is the line between devotion and brainwashing? Can you truly travel and give yourself to God? One of the protagonists in the podcast has written a book. She was part of the Mother Teresa Missionaries of Charity. They call them the MCs. She was part of this group for 2 decades and was very close friends with Mother Teresa and was very involved in that. So she's written this book after she left, and it's very, very difficult to leave, which is one of the definitions, for me anyway, of a cult. Of if they don't just unlock the door and let you walk away, why aren't they doing that? And what is it that's keeping you there? Well, they didn't let these people just leave. This show's got 9 episodes. So it's a fairly contained story that is certainly binge-worthy. It's going to be tough to turn this one off because it is a story that, almost like religion itself, we have this mythological belief in Mother Teresa and what she was doing. This podcast breaks down a lot of that. So it's uncomfortable at times to have what you've thought about and known about your entire life to be sort of stripped away and be forced to look at it in a different light. And that creates, you know, uneasiness as you're listening to this stuff. But it can't be denied. It can't be discarded because this isn't some investigative journalist coming in from the outside at the 30,000 foot view. This is somebody who was on the floor of this place every single day with Mother Teresa. So it's a difficult thing. My relationship with the Catholic Church and Mother Teresa is complicated. I am no fan of Mother Teresa. I don't give her the credit that many do. She's been given sainthood, which I would completely disagree with. I'm not or no longer part of the Catholic Church, but if there was a vote, I wouldn't vote for her. A lot of this information came out in a documentary years ago and by a book actually by Christopher Hitchens called Hell's Angel. The documentary is available on YouTube. It's only a 30-minute documentary, but it gives you a deep dive inside what Mother Teresa's ministry in Calcutta, India was, which was not exactly what we all thought. And Mother Teresa is a complicated figure socially, politically. Frankly, if she said these things today, in our cancer culture, she would be canceled almost instantly before she walked off the stage with some of the things she said. But we don't always like to look back at our saints like that. And I don't think she's much of a saint. I think she's a difficult personality at best. You know, I went into this thinking that this doesn't necessarily change my mind, but it does give me a much better insight into her thinking and why she was the way she was. And that's really what my quest is in all these religious things, is why people do what they do, not what they do. Anyway, I thought this was a pretty interesting podcast and certainly binge-worthy. At 9 episodes, it's a lot of good information.
When this podcaster was embedded as a nun, when are we talking? What's the timeline?
She's relatively young. So she was not a nun in the Missionaries of Charity. She talks about when she was in second grade making a list of all the things she wanted to be, and one of them was a nun, which is she wasn't Catholic, but she ultimately, I think when she was about 19, went to study to be a nun. She didn't do it for very long, but she certainly, having gone all through Catholic school and studied to be a nun, has a pretty good understanding of what the nun life is and what the requirements are. So her experience of being a nun is one thing. What these folks experience being part of Mother Teresa's thing is like a completely different religion. I mean, they are deep diving into stuff They're shaving your head and singing little songs, and they're locking the doors. You're not allowed to talk to anybody. You're never allowed to touch anybody. You're not allowed to shower. You must just dump buckets of water over your head.
So the gal that's telling the stories, she was not part of this.
No, but this podcast was inspired by a book. And the woman who wrote the book, who was embedded in this group for 20 years, wrote the book, and she's the major protagonist in the story. So she's being interviewed by this podcaster. And then, you know, the larger story of Mother Teresa is told by the podcaster, but the internal stuff of these kinds of things are told by the person who experienced it. And she was a young woman at the time, and she was, you know, 18, 19 or something. And this is in the 70s when she went to New York by herself and found this place. And she went there specifically to join this order. And then it just is sort of unveiling her 20-something years inside the Missionaries of Charity, which is scary, frankly, just scary.
I think it's interesting that we both gravitated towards podcast with the theme of religion in mind, and came back with stories that are almost like investigative journalism.
Mm-hmm.
I found same with the challenge of looking for a great comedy podcast. I found it difficult to find a great podcast that was religious that I could connect with, that wasn't going to be like just a series of weekly sermons or reflections and daily devotions, which I find easier to access from people within my own community, from church leaders that I know and can relate to, that I have a relationship with. Got plenty more of those I can recommend at a later date.
And, you know, as we talked about before, these genres, these categories in podcasts are so wide. There isn't one that's a genre that says the fall of churches, which I'm sure there's probably dozens of podcasts that deal with just that topic. So we're picking these big topics, and we'll circle back around to a lot of these things and give you different ones, because I've got several that fall under the umbrella of religion that are not particularly religious. Let's move on to our wild card of the week.
This week, I found a show on Amazon Prime that is hilarious. It's going to be a palate cleanser. It's a show called Frank of Ireland, and it's on Amazon Prime. Have you heard of it?
Mm-hmm.
Did you watch it?
I have not.
Oh, it's a fun binge.
I saw the trailer, and I thought it would look pretty good.
So during the pandemic, Brian and Domhnall Gleeson, who are brothers, decided to put together a project television series based on some characters that they'd been kind of workshopping with each other. And because they were quarantined and family, they figured, well, we're, you know, in a bubble. Let's just go ahead and finally produce this thing. And if you don't know the name Brian Gleeson, he is the brother of Domhnall Gleeson, who is the eldest of the Harry Potter Weasley brothers. He's the eldest redheaded brother.
This may be off the wall, but are they related to Brendan Gleeson?
Yes!
The older character actor.
The one who played Mad-Eye Moody, also in Harry Potter. He's their dad in real life.
Oh, really?
Yeah. He's a fantastic actor, and he's a comedic actor in this. He shows up in a couple of the later episodes. One season, and the episodes themselves are only about 24 minutes long, so you can accidentally binge this entire season and in the length of maybe a 3.5-hour movie. You know, you sit there and just watch the whole thing straight from start to finish, and it is absolutely a laugh-a-minute hysterical riot. Absolutely loved it. And then I also have a challenge of the week, but I'll hang on to that. So I want to hear what was your wild card.
My wild card is going to be very wild, because this seems like such a niche thing. I can tell you that it's not, because once you watch it, you'll realize you don't have to be interested in the subject matter to like the show. It's called Drive to Survive. They're in season 3, comes out every February. And this is a documentary series on Formula One racing. And I know that there are thousands of you out there, many of them my family members, that when I mention Formula One, they tune out or they walk away. If I mention auto racing in any way, shape, or form, they walk away. If I'm FaceTiming my son and I mention auto racing, he hangs up on me. He doesn't want anything to do with it. However, my other son, who had the same reaction, watched this series, and he could not stop watching it for 2 straight days, and he became a Formula One fan.
And he's not interested in racing.
Was not interested in racing.
And Formula One is very different from NASCAR, right? It's a very different culture and environment, different kinds of cars.
Yes.
I'm assuming different types of politics, because Formula One's more European, isn't it?
Formula One is, when you win the championship in Formula One, you are called the world champion, which you are not in any other form of racing. It is considered to be the highest form of racing in the world. And that's certainly a debatable topic when you have terrific NASCAR drivers and IndyCar drivers and sports car drivers and all these people that are driving race cars at a very, very high level. They may not even aspire to Formula One, but Formula One is this elitist thing. So probably the most famous Formula One race that anybody's ever heard of is the Monaco Grand Prix. So that's been going on in Monte Carlo for 100 years.
Is that the one that they did in Cars 2?
See, now we talked about this before. That's animated.
I know.
But probably is.
And not my favorite of the Cars franchise movies either.
And I didn't know they made more than one of those.
Now, Formula One, these are the long, skinny cars that have the parachutes that pop out the back, right?
No, those are dragsters. Those are going a quarter mile straight down the line. A Formula One car looks similar to the cars that race at Indianapolis, but if you look closer, they're nothing like that. These are basically prototype cars. There are manufacturers that are involved in Formula One, and then there are private teams involved in Formula One. Cars that the manufacturer involved are Mercedes-Benz, Ferrari, McLaren. McLaren and Ferrari are not making cars for you and I to go buy off the car lot. These are very, very high-end cars. So the reason Formula One sort of exists is these high-end car companies. Honda makes a motor. Renault makes a motor. Aston Martin is part of Formula One. They build these cars and they test all the things that we have in our cars right now, the safety things, the driver assist things. That was all developed in Formula One, and then it filters down to their passenger car. So ABS brakes in your car right now, when you hit the brakes and you don't come to a skidding, you don't skid, that was developed in Formula One. And it trickles down to the passenger cars. Driver assist, all that stuff. Power brakes, power steering, you name the innovation. Even hybrids now that we're driving hybrid era cars, the Formula One cars are hybrids. So they're part electric and part fuel. They're not gasoline, but they're part fuel. So they're developing this hybrid technology at the highest level for reliability. You know, that's basically Formula One racing. And you have these worldwide drivers. There currently are no American drivers driving in Formula One. This is a driver series where in NASCAR, you might find a guy who's 45 and still winning and still chugging along. And you're not going to find that in Formula One. The youngest driver right now in Formula One is, I believe he's 18. And the oldest driver in Formula One is 36, 38. So these, you know, at 38, you're pretty much on the other side. Most people are retiring 32, 33. It's just a very, very, very intense thing. So you may not ever want to watch a race, but if you want to see what's behind the scenes of these kinds of racing efforts that spend hundreds of millions of dollars, Mercedes-Benz spends $400 million a year on their Formula One program. They have over 4,000 employees of their Formula One program. We hear about the driver and the mechanic and the guy changing the tire, but they have entire teams that are taking care of this stuff. They have a building dedicated to aerodynamics. They have a motor division. I mean, it's phenomenal.
So clearly this wild card of yours opened up a Pandora's box. Maybe I should have encouraged you. Now we're just going to
It opens Pandora's. Racing. But having said all of that, this show's not about any of that.
Oh my Lord. Well, you know, for the first time ever, while you're talking about Formula One, it occurred to me that you sound like you're describing like haute couture, like high fashion, because they design these absurd things for the catwalk that trickles down eventually to JCPenney's and, you know,
right,
Macy's shoppers. That's eventually,
good,
you know.
It's a very good analogy.
The end of the next season.
Yep. And drivers that leave Formula One, retire or get fired or move on, we'll see those guys pop up in NASCAR, in IndyCar, in sports cars. So they rise to the top and then they'll hit these other places on the way down. But what makes this series so interesting is it doesn't have much to do with the racing. Really, Formula One really is this massive soap opera of these prima donna, young, extraordinarily wealthy drivers. And most of them came from extraordinarily wealthy families. And the politics and the internal backbiting that goes on between the teams and the drivers and the crews. And it is truly a reality series that is maybe the best thing going. It has boosted Formula One as a in popularity in the US by, I don't know, 150%, 1,000%. These guys that make this documentary series are the same guys who made a documentary called Senna about 10 years ago about Ayrton Senna, who was a Formula One driver. They're very good because they don't use a narrator. It's all done with interviews, and they tell these stories through various interviews, and they tell terrific stories. Take Formula One out of it. If you ever saw the Amy Winehouse documentary on Netflix, which is terrific.
I did, actually.
Same filmmakers. So it's if you look at their style is very effective. And this show is just, I do have a close friend who, once again, had nothing to do with racing. He couldn't care less. And he and his wife sat down, and they started to watch this. And I kid you not, I get 15 to 20 texts a week from him talking about Formula One. He and his wife spend their entire week listening to Formula One podcasts, watching pre-race, and they are up at 6 in the morning watching these shows, these races that come from Europe, because they are into it. Because you're not now just watching a car and its top of a helmet go around. You know who these people are. You know the personalities. You've met their families. You know their insecurities. You know where they came from. You know everything that they like and dislike. They'll talk about drivers that they hate. And pretty soon you watch the race. Here's these two guys going around a corner and they're bumping. And you go, that has nothing to do with the race. That has to do with what happened yesterday. So it really is makes the race more interesting because it brings all this stuff onto the track, which we never knew before. And it's a real look behind the curtain. It's a Wizard of Oz moment.
Huh. And what was the name of the show again?
It's called Drive to Survive. It just finished season 3. So you can binge it. They're half hour longs. And the stuff they show of racing is minuscule. It'll be of a 30-minute episode, you might see 30 seconds of racing. It really is about people.
I might actually check it out because, as you know, I've become kind of a gearhead since I bought my Audi.
These are... You know, these handsome European 22-year-old, 25-year-old race drivers that, you know, are doing quite fine with the ladies. So they tune in too.
I'll tune in with my teenage daughters.
Oh, there's eye candy to be had. And the eye candy for the gentleman out there is the eye candy that these young men travel around with.
All right. So I have a challenge for you.
Oh, good. I can't wait.
I think you're going to dig this because it's I've been told by a young man who is an up and coming filmmaker friend of mine that this HBO special is like a filmmaker's film for filmmakers, and it's called Bo Burnham Inside.
I've seen the thumbnail and clicked on it, and if I click it again, it'll say resume, but I never got past.
You
got to
resume.
He seems like an interesting character.
He's been around for a while. He's a comedian who's been doing YouTube stuff, and he's kind of like this generation's Weird Al Yankovic, but smarter. So his songs that he performs in this piece are all related to what was going on during the pandemic. So it's very current, very relatable. And my daughters just absolutely fell in love with the whole special. It's about 2 hours. He shot the entire thing completely alone inside his apartment during the quarantine.
That's my wheelhouse. That's me all the time.
Pushing buttons by himself, hitting the remote control, performing with the pedals to change the lights during the middle of a shot. I mean, you watch his beard grow during the course of this 2-hour special because it took him 13 months to put it together. And just freaking fantastic. The level of attention to detail, his storytelling, his humor. He basically is his thesis. Here is that he's going to heal the world through comedy. And he did a pretty good job for us entertaining our family and opening up a new set of songs for my daughters to binge. Since Hamilton, you know, they have a habit of memorizing every word to everything. This week, it's been all of Bo Burnham's songs from Inside.
And he's got a few other specials as well.
I actually watched one of his short films. It's actually a music video. It's called Repeat Stuff. I checked that out yesterday on YouTube, and it's pretty funny. It's kind of a mock satirical romantic boy band song. And he kind of breaks it down, tells you about how music producers prevent songwriters from really writing good stuff because it's supposed to be marketable. And in the middle of the song, his chorus is, so repeat stuff, repeat stuff, repeat stuff. I just thought it was really cute.
It's not a straight stand-up. He's like a variety kind of.
It's like a variety show, mostly musical. variety show. Right. He does have a couple other specials that I've seen in the thumbnails. I haven't binge watched them all yet.
But and it's just him.
Just him, all by himself. Literally inside the entire time.
All right, Bo Burnham, that's my challenge.
Yeah, and okay. It's not a hard challenge. I didn't pick something that was going to make you crazy.
I picked something for you that is only, maybe it's 12 minutes long, so it's not a deep dive, but it's going to be a challenge. I can't wait for you to see this. I can't wait. It's called, What Did Jack Do? Did I tell you about this in the past?
I don't think so.
Are you familiar with David Lynch?
Yeah.
Okay. So David Lynch did Blue Velvet and Mulholland Drive mm-hmm. and Eraserhead, and he did Twin Peaks on television.
Very weird stuff.
David Lynch is to me one of my top five favorite filmmakers. That's not to say I like everything he does. Some stuff I dislike it intensely. But what I like about him is his boldness to do what he wants to do. You know, David Lynch is probably 70 now, or maybe in his 70s. And he does a lot of artwork. He does a lot of poetry. He writes. He has this website where he makes all these short films. Well, he made this short film called What Did Jack Do? Again, I think it's around 12, 14 minutes long. Let me read you the description of What Did Jack Do? What Did Jack Do is a 2017 American black and white short film and directed by David Lynch. He also stars in it. It premiered on November 8th, 2017 in Paris. In the film, a detective played by Lynch interrogates a Capuchin monkey. David Lynch interrogates a Capuchin monkey who possibly committed a murder.
And I'm guessing that the monkey is Jack.
The monkey is Jack. So the Capuchin monkeys, if you don't know what those are the little tiny monkeys that in movies they used to have is, you know, organ grinder would have a monkey. So this monkey's wearing a suit and the monkey talks. So there's a full-on interrogation. They're on a train. So it's really a film noir because it's black and white, and David Lynch always dresses in these, you know, sort of old-fashioned suits. So when it comes on, you think that this is going to be this fantastic film noir. Now, it's fantastic in its boldness, in the writing. The writing is so good that you can't stop watching it. And I can't tell you that you're going to love it. I've watched it 100 times and like it more every time I see it. After you get past the part where you look at it and you go, he's talking to a monkey and the monkey is talking back, you can't take the smile off your face because it's just so enjoyable to watch this interaction, you know, and they're smoking and the whole film noir thing. And it's just great. And then I'm not going to give you the spoiler because there is a spoiler that the film reaches its climax and something goes wrong. I recommend that to almost everybody I see, and I would say 95% look at me and go, why did you make me watch that? But that 5% out there, we're just carrying that David Lynch mantle.
Now, I did ask you to go and watch Umbrella Academy.
Yes,
so what did you think? I know at the top of the show you said you had some negative things to say.
I really wanted to like Umbrella Academy. I really did. And there's some of it that I really did like. I think those shows in that genre all look really good. I think that show looks really good. And when I'm talking about look, I'm talking about production design, cinematography, special effects, which we'll talk about this movie that I saw the other night, which I thought was just horrific on Amazon. And the special effects were like third rate, but the special effects in Umbrella Academy, top drawer performances. There was nothing I didn't like it about watching it. I didn't like any of the characters. I never felt a connection to these characters. I actually started to like one guy, and then, I mean, they're definitely anti-heroes. I get that. But even in my anti-heroes, I want something to connect to. You know, even when I watched Dirty Harry and he was the anti-hero blowing up San Francisco, there was something about him. There's something about anti-heroes, you know, Death Wish movies. I love anti-hero movies, but I can't quite grab into this thing. They too have a monkey, which I was shocked as there was a dialogue and all of a sudden a monkey shows up wearing a suit and he's on a cane and he starts talking. And so we're in this. We're in this world. It felt very overdone, almost like you're pushing these people on me too much. I don't think the characters were that well developed. And I don't think that they grabbed me. And I watched 3 episodes. So I watched 3 hours of this thing. And I'm still not pulled in. And I'm not compelled enough by the story. And I think part of the problem is I'm not really drawn to apocalyptic stories, which seems like almost everything is apocalyptic these days. They're riding this bandwagon. They're riding the Walking Dead and almost all of these apocalyptic things. And there's, to me, they just looked at it and went, let's do an apocalyptic show. And that was their first premise. And then they're like, let's build this secondary. When I think when you're building a show, build me some interesting characters and some situations and then set the scene. I just felt like it's low-hanging fruit to go after. It's like saying the F word when we talked about the comedians. It's low-hanging fruit to have apocalyptic things. To me, it's way more interesting to see people with different abilities operate in a modern world. A modern way of just living.
But without being able, without putting them in the challenging position of having to save the world, they're just people with some interesting special power.
It was a big leap to get to pluck these. The beginning scenes, I thought this is great. It's going to have some heart. It's going to have some tongue in cheek. They're gonna go, okay, we know what we're doing here. And it just got heavier and heavier and heavier, and it lost its charm. It lost its charm of... I mean, this guy who goes and gets the kids, he steals them or buys them. He's buying children. And they set him up like he's this kind of nice guy, but then he doesn't give them names and he's kind of evil and he's spying on them. Like,
they go into that stuff in second season.
It kind of reminded me of the Vatican.
there's a lot more backstory and origin story stuff told in second season. And they further develop some of the best characters in the show.
They should have flip-flopped it. You got to grab early because I'm never getting to the second season.
I think they did have some growing pains at the beginning, but you only watched the first 3 episodes. So
yeah, and it didn't. I figured by 3 hours in, if you're not grabbing me 3 hours in, then I thought the second episode was particularly weak. I thought the second episode was where they were trying to go give me backstory, but the backstory wasn't compelling. You know, the guy sort of, I don't want to give spoilers, but the sort of substance abuse guy, he just got on my nerves after a while. Just
the flamboyant one?
The one who's got the drug problem.
Yeah, he is going to be awesome in the next season. Well, if
you
hold on.
You know,
Those of you that are watching that are fans of Umbrella Academy know what I'm talking about.
I liked him when he came on because, you know, I thought he was really funny and he had some smart things to say in the way he approached things. But then he just sort of dilapidated into your typical...
He has a fantastic story arc where he becomes a cult leader.
It doesn't surprise me because, I mean, they set him up as not stupid. But that's part of... To me, that's part of the inconsistencies. These characters were inconsistent from scene to scene. It's like, well, why are you doing this? Because in the previous scene, you do that. That's not the actor's fault. That is the director's fault and the writer's fault. They're not reconciling some of these things. To me, I looked at a lot of the stuff and... They wrote it down and said, this would be a really cool scene to do. Yes, it's a really cool scene. It doesn't belong in your show. There are different ways to produce shows, and sometimes you fall in love with your own footage. God knows I can show you films that I made that I fell in love with footage, and I watch 20 years later and go, holy cow, why did I leave that in there?
Well, you make a point. It is a large ensemble cast with very complex characters. It takes a lot longer to develop them and build it out, I think. And I think maybe there is a bit of a kitchen sink scenario here where they're putting everything in. You know, like you said, the superhero powers and the apocalypse kind of piled on top of these complex relationships that the characters have with their backstory and their origin story. And maybe if they had stripped some of that stuff out, you would have liked it.
Well, the big guy that was on the moon.
Yeah.
Right. So I assume when I'm seeing this guy on the moon doing science experiments, he's a pretty bright guy. You put in the room with his other Umbrella Academy, he's a nitwit.
Yeah.
He's just like, that's
the muscle.
That's the disconnect. It doesn't make sense to have this muscle guy doing this stuff. And they do it with some throwaway line. Oh yeah, Dad didn't like you. That's why he sent you to the moon.
Mm-hmm.
Well, you can't do that and be an idiot at the same time. I mean, you can have a personality problem, but this guy just is dumb. Like, you can't be dumb.
He is hard to look at as far as... character too, because he's half ape. And he's all hairy. And
he's half ape?
Yeah. Well, you haven't gotten to that part yet, have you?
Well, I see he's massive. I just figure he's like his giant, you know, bodybuilder type. He's part ape. Well, how does that work?
Well, you'd have to watch more.
I don't want to watch it at all. We already covered the one before where he was the sheep kid or the deer kid.
Okay, well, let me tell you what I felt about your million ways to die in the West.
Is it 10 million or a million ways to
die? A million ways to die in the West.
There's a lot of ways.
Yeah. No, I had seen it before and I had forgotten. So I guess it hadn't made a huge impression on me.
And you hated it, huh?
No, I didn't hate it. No, actually, there was plenty of it that I thought was pretty funny. And it's been a couple weeks now since I went home and watched it after you gave me my assignments. So I thought Seth MacFarlane was cute. There were some scenes in there that I could have done without. There's like this horrifying diarrhea scene in the middle of the road.
Agreed.
There's some dumb boy humor in there, quite a bit.
I would agree. And one of the reasons that Seth MacFarlane frustrates me at times, because I think he can do some smart stuff, but he really does like junior high school boys humor. And I'm not a really fan of that. So I had to kind of overlook that stuff because I thought, again, low hanging fruit, easy to do, right? That particular scene you're talking about, I actually fast forwarded through that. Like, I don't need, this doesn't add anything. It's not making the movie better. It's, you know, sometimes stupid stuff makes the movie better. You understand these characters better. This was just gratuitous.
Yeah. I got a kick out of the almost stand-up comedy moments that Seth MacFarlane's character would have, where he would rant about all the ways that you can die in the West. And it's almost the way the movie begins. You know, he's starting with, you know, telling everybody about how you could die basically from farting. And just kind of going through that narrative, and I thought that was kind of clever. And there are some moments where you felt like he was going to break that fourth wall and talk directly to the camera. I got a kick out of that kind of meta.
Right.
You know, this guy's perfectly aware. He's almost as if he's a time traveler who's been placed in the South or in the West in, you know, the 1900s.
And people die at the carnivals. That's what you have to.
Yeah, and the dying in the carnival. That was.
You got to know people die at the carnival.
There are definitely scenes that made me laugh. No, it was a good comedy. But I would take points away for some of the dumber boy humor.
And I would agree with you on that. And I know your sensibilities. That's not the scene I thought you were going to hate. I thought you were going to hate the Sarah Silverman stuff.
Oh, yeah, that too. No, I forgot. No, thank you for reminding me. Sarah Silverman's character as a prostitute.
With Giovanni Ribisi.
Did not have to be as descriptive as she was.
Yes, she did.
No, I could have totally done without that.
Yes. See, that's the kind of junior high school stuff I can wrap my mind around.
No, that was kind of cringy.
It was very cringy. It was hard to listen to. And I think that's they cast it perfectly because Sarah Silverman does that.
Yeah.
And no one could do that and get away with it except her.
And I think you recommended it to me because you knew I hated Sarah Silverman.
Yeah, that's why. And I knew she was going to talk about stuff that you were going to hate.
Well, you know, we'll talk in another episode about other challenges that you've given me. And it seems like you're kind of pushing the junior high school. Yeah, like you said, the junior high school boy humor.
Yeah, I will admit that I have a late night watch list. And Million Ways to Die is now on that list. Hot Tub Time Machine is on that list.
Oh, wow. I mean,
these are...
You would like Tag, if you haven't seen Tag.
I haven't seen Tag, but it may be...
A group of grown men that are still playing Tag after 30 years.
It's on my DVR. But I don't know, because here I talk about all this stuff that bothers me about the Umbrella Academy and this character development and stuff. And then I love Million Ways to Die. And I love Hot Tub Time Machine because it's just absurd. And sometimes late at night, if I'm watching television, and that's when I watch these things, I don't just turn them on for my mid-evening viewing. I watch them because I just want to not think about anything. I watch them to just relax and just laugh. Some of it's going to be really funny and some of it's going to be really terrible.
You'll enjoy Frank of Ireland. Because those two boys are such, well, actually one of the characters' name is Doofus. So like it's like a Dumb and Dumber, but with English accents. And these guys are hilarious together.
I just love these. Well, I loved Blazing Saddles when I was a kid. And I just love absurd. I'm a Mel Brooks fan. You know, I just love stupidity. And Million Ways to Die to me was a modern, if Mel Brooks was making Western comedies today, he would do that.
Oh, yeah.
Because Mel Brooks was nothing but seventh grade
comedy. It
was like
comedy. An homage to Mel Brooks.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. Yeah. But and it, the eye candy, though. Charlize Theron is. That's...
way out of his league.
Well, she's way out of all of our league. But it's nice to watch those leagues play. I don't know. Seth MacFarlane, he's an interesting guy. You know, he recorded an album with Barbra Streisand.
No,
he's performed with the San Francisco Symphony. He goes around, he sings classical. He's like this crooner that he performs, and then he writes comedy, and then he produces.
And he does the voice for the characters in Family Guy.
Well, he created those shows. Those are all his. And then he also executive produced Cosmos with Neil deGrasse Tyson. That's his show.
Really?
Yes. Yeah. He's this huge science nerd.
Wow. Hidden skills.
He's so talented. And he can dance. He can sing. He's a comedian. He's a very good dramatic actor.
And apparently he can ride a horse.
And he can ride a horse. And he's one of those guys, as I've said before, I like a lot of what he does. I don't like most of what he does. I don't watch Family Guy. I'm probably one of the only person in the country that don't. But again, goes back to animation. I'm not a big cartoon fan.
I was never a fan of that show either.
So, yeah, that's not going to be in your wheelhouse. That's the Sarah Silverman side of the fence. So.
I was the mom, the mean mom that wouldn't let my kids watch SpongeBob.
Oh.
I said, you can watch Phineas and Ferb. Those kids are geniuses. But we're not going to watch SpongeBob. He's a total ding-dong.
There were some things I never even exposed my kids to because I knew they would like it. So I would record things and give them the tapes to watch of the stuff I could tolerate. You know, like VeggieTales or Arthur or things like that. But I wouldn't even tell them some of these other things are on because I thought, oh, they're going to like that.
Yeah. We kept our channels on, you know, Disney or PBS. That's why they missed SpongeBob because it was on Nickelodeon. And mm-hmm. they have friends who are like Team Nickelodeon who watched all the stuff I wouldn't let them watch. And they come home, Mom, you're so mean. You know?
SpongeBob was pretty great, though.
Well, it just, I am aware of the show. You know, I'd watched a couple, so I knew. I was like, yeah, it just kind of celebrated stupidity, and I just didn't want to have that be the model.
SpongeBob was kind of a throwback to the old Warner Brothers cartoons where they wrote for adults as well. So the kids are getting sucked in by the color and the goofy things, but the parents can laugh at these jokes because they wrote for, you know, themselves. I could tolerate SpongeBob. I could deal with them. My kids used to get mad because I still couldn't wrap my mind around the idea that they're underwater, and you know, they get pissed because I'm very pragmatic that way. I'm like, it doesn't make sense. You know, I don't know, how did he get square pants?
But
I don't know where he got square pants.
But this David Lynch thing with the talking monkey, you're okay with?
It's not animated. It's real.
All right. Well, let's wrap up. This week we discussed religion. My show recommendation for the week was The Rise and Fall of Mars Hill. Check it out. Like I said, there's only two episodes out now, but when the series is complete, I think it's going to have a pretty strong story arc.
And your wild card of the week was?
My wild card of the week was Frank of Ireland on Amazon Prime. But my challenge for you for this week is to go watch Bo Burnham's special, Inside. I believe it's on HBO Plus.
Yeah,
no, Netflix. You said you saw the thing. Okay,
I think it was Netflix that I saw the thumbnail. Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, yeah. No, that's a good recommendation. That's not going to be a hard one. My challenge for you is going to be much harder for you.
It's only 12 minutes. I can survive.
That's why I made it short. In fact, when we finish this, we should just watch it. Because I love it so much. My podcast for the week was The Turning, Sisters Who Left, about the religious order of missionaries of charity who are the followers. Is that what we call them? More than followers. They were in the missionary of Mother Teresa. And my wild card of the week was Drive to Survive, the behind-the-scenes soap opera of Formula One racing. And if you like reality television, then you will love this show, regardless of the content, because you can't tell me that those of you out there watching The Bachelor are fascinated with the dating scene of the 20s. No, you're watching it for some other reason. And if it's eye candy that you're watching it for, you'll like Formula One too, because there's lots of that. And my wild card was, not my wild card, my challenge, my homework was, What Did Jack Do? The 1917, 19, I can't speak, 1917 That's why it's in black and white. The 2017 black and white short film, the noir film, What Did Jack Do? So when we come back in a couple weeks, we'll have a report on Bo Burnham and What Did Jack Do?
Stay tuned.
Stay tuned.
So thanks for listening. As always, this was tons of fun. Thank you, Jeff. I'm Lori Butler.
And I'm Jeff Argent.
And this has been BingeCast.